Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, I'm going to talk about Bentwaters, Rendlesham Forest. In fact, the title of this commentary is called Rendlesham Rising. I've just been advised that the long-awaited documentary about Rendlesham called Capel Green will be premiering soon. So I thought I would put in my two cents worth as someone who has studied this series of events culminating in the final night, September 28th, 1980, when Larry Warren, Adrian Bastinza, and others had their close encounter, not only with a landed craft — Larry was within touching distance of said landed craft — but they witnessed three diminutive alien beings come out of this craft. Quite timely that this documentary is coming out. As expected, we're getting a lot of pushback from the lamestream dinosaur media about how the whole concept of aliens, UFOs, crash retrievals, etc., has just been one long disinformation, psychological warfare ploy. Where have we heard that before? We've seen various iterations of this. A classic example with very dark undertones is the personal attack, because I can't see it as anything else, the personal attack on the late, great Paul Benowitz, who was investigating the alien activity in Archuleta Mesa, the underground base there, not too far from Dulce, by the way. And what did the Air Force at Kirtland Air Force Base say? Well, the spin they put out is that, well, the aliens and the UFOs and all the UFO activity, that's just a ploy to divert attention from the weapons, advanced weapons testing, which is nonsense. That's like putting the cart before the horse. These aliens show up when the humans are conducting weapons of mass destruction testing and programs. That's a documented fact, and I'll get into that. A friend of mine used to conduct a lot of sky watches near Point Magoo Naval Weapons Station. He told me that there would be UFOs flying around while they were testing what seemed to be beam weaponry, light beings being shot into the sky, and there were UFOs flying around. We've heard similar reports many times out of the nuclear weapons testing in the Pacific when many people, and I spoke to one of these individuals, Native American guy, he was a sailor, and he said that in one of the nuclear tests he took part in the Pacific, there were UFOs flying around all over the place. And that is a key component of the Rendlesham Forest story. So for them to suggest that aliens and UFOs, crash retrievals, Roswell, what have you, is just an elaborate hoax to conceal advanced weapons testing, that's nonsense. That's like putting the cart before the horse, like I said. It's a non-starter. It's a dying last grasp for the legacy, soon-to-be-extinct media. And shortly, Capel Green, the documentary about Rendlesham Forest, will be coming out soon, and that will be the final nail in the coffin of the UFO cover-up and the final nail in the coffin for all the lamestream media outlets that keep insisting that there's nothing to UFOs, it's all just an elaborate hoax and a psyop. Like many others, my first exposure to Bentwaters was the Unsolved Mysteries segment that came out many years ago, and it featured the likes of John Burroughs and Colonel Halt. There was discussion in the segment about the Halt memo, and there was testimony from Burroughs and some of the other airmen about chasing these lights through the forest. That's when I was still living in San Jose, California. And then fast forward, I moved to San Diego at the bottom of the state. Before too long, I joined the San Diego UFO Society, and I started attending UFO lectures and conferences. And I went to a large conference in Los Angeles, if memory serves, and Chuck DeCaro was there. Chuck DeCaro was one of the mainstream reporters who covered the Bentwaters story, the Rendlesham Forest story, or aspects of it. I expected to get more information to kind of flesh out what little I gleaned from that Unsolved Mystery segment, but instead, I'm sitting there in a darkened lecture hall, and I'm just listening to DeCaro talk about his exploits, jumping out of airplanes with Air Force combat controllers. In fact, he showed a video clip of him jumping out of an airplane with these Air Force combat controllers. And he talked about a few more of his exploits, this, that, and the other, but nothing really about Bentwaters. So there was a bit of false advertising there. When I looked at the program, Chuck DeCaro, investigative reporter, going to be talking about Bentwaters. Okay, this is right up my alley. None of these other lectures lined up around the same time look as appealing to me. I'm going to go to Chuck DeCaro. Big waste of time. Disappointment, let down. Things pretty much stayed the same until finally I had the opportunity to hear the story straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. One Larry Warren. Larry had come to San Diego to give a presentation at the San Diego UFO Society. His business manager or road manager at the time, I never quite figured out the guy's actual title, was Russ Estes. And I'll talk more about Russ Estes before this segment is over. I will be appearing on the Capel Green documentary, where I talk at length about Russ Estes. He was a government agent, and he was basically sent into Larry Warren's life to disrupt Larry Warren's life and to derail him and create chaos and confusion and to burn bridges with every single UFO conference promoter on the planet, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So Russ Estes plays this video prelude talking about Bentwaters, showing footage of the airbase and the perimeter fence, etc. And then he introduced Larry Warren. And we all applaud. And by this time, I'd also read articles about Larry Warren in various UFO magazines. I read the account of Larry meeting with Jackie Gleason at Jackie Gleason's big UFO house, and they had a discussion about UFOs, and I'd read a few other accounts. And basically, I tried to get anything I could find on Bentwaters, and there was a little bit of information in Clear Intent, the book, which later the title was changed to The UFO Cover-Up by Fawcett and Greenwood, but again, not really a whole lot to sink your teeth into. So here's the man himself, Larry Warren. And when Larry gave his introductory talks to his presentation, he mentioned something along the lines of the significance of Rendlesham Forest, of Bentwaters, seeds perhaps even Roswell. And I was somewhat taken aback by that comment. I go, wow, really? You think so? Bigger than Roswell? And now with the benefit of hindsight, and again, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Well, yes, I absolutely agree with that assessment for a number of reasons, which I'll get into. So right off the bat, I was kind of shaken out of my gourd when Larry said that this is as big as Roswell. It's often been billed as or described as Britain's Roswell or Britain's answer to Roswell. But when Larry said that this is potentially, in so many words, as big as Roswell, as significant as Roswell, to be perfectly blunt, I was somewhat taken aback. Okay, well, let's hear it. Okay, I was all ears, open-minded. And Larry gave a story. It was a poignant story, compelling story. And because I'd gone through alien experiences myself, because I'd gone through ridicule and had to endure jeering comments from people I thought were friends, people I thought were intelligent friends, I looked at and listened to Larry's presentation from the perspective of another abductee. Because Larry opined during the presentation that he himself had had alien experiences, and he talked about some of his ET experiences during his childhood and growing up. Larry went into detail into what happened. The third night, Capel Green clearing, the lighted unusual mist, the red light that came in from the ocean and silently blew up in a blinding flash of light. And when the light cleared, there sat a triangular delta-shaped craft. He went into the whole story. The confusion amongst the personnel involved, the light alls wouldn't work. Some of this was described and depicted in the Unsolved Mysteries segment, but it didn't go into the detail that Larry provided, detail that only someone who was there could have provided. Larry described what's been called the Oz effect, the high strangeness aspect of the experience. How people would take a step and there was a fractional time lag between the step of the individual and the shadow of the individual catching up. It seemed to be like a half step behind people when they were walking. It had something to do with some kind of distortion of time or the environment by the craft itself. Larry talked about retinal burns, people suffering from radiation exposure. He talked about Colonel Gordon Williams having the encounter with the three aliens that came out of the craft. And all of that was compelling enough, but the aftermath, and Larry emphasized when we took the break, he took the break. Okay, there's a good time to have a break, and then we'll come back. But don't go away because I'm just getting started. The second part of the presentation, the aftermath of the events on December 28th, are, if anything, even more important than what happened at the Capel Green clearing itself. So after the break, Larry comes on and he starts talking about what happened afterwards. Larry mentioned, well, now he said in so many words, now it's really in vogue and a lot of people are talking about underground bases and being taken to underground bases. Well, that happened to me. I was one of the first people that described being taken to an underground base. And that's what happened. There was an underground base beneath Bentwaters. And Larry and others, other airmen who were there, were taken underneath the surface. If you read a lot of the literature that's come out, Larry's book, Left at Eastgate, Gary Heseltine, who I've had on the show, he's come out with his most recent work about Bentwaters, Rendlesham Forest. There is a photo lab on the base, which contains a secret passageway into an underground facility. And Larry was taken beneath there. He was basically shanghaied off the surface by government agents, could have been OSI, Office of Special Investigations, and taken underground, drugged, and then at one point, he was put before a large view screen, behind which was some kind of a silhouette or an ET, but a silhouette, a big head, that was talking to him telepathically. I've heard similar things from other people. Larry described this, that the being was talking to him from behind this partition or screen. Then eventually they turned him loose and he was back up on the surface, where he was subjected to a lot of hazing, a lot of harassment, a lot of intimidation, et cetera, et cetera. And so by this point, I'm sitting there and I'm saying, yes, this is as big, if not bigger, than Roswell. And here's why I say that. Yes, I say this with the benefit of some degree of hindsight. I've done a lot of research about the subject since then. But at that moment, especially after he talked about what happened, being kidnapped, taken downstairs, and the drugging, and then the harassment, all of which just irked me no end, because I hate it, absolutely hate, with a capital H, when law-abiding, good people, minding their own business, caught up in stuff they had no awareness of or even any real involvement in, get reeled in through circumstances, and then they start getting harassed and messed with. That just pisses me off. I hate it when that happens. And so Larry tells a story, and he talked about the aftermath of harassment, what have you. And when I realized that, yes, this is as big, if not bigger, than Roswell, there's a historical context to that. A lot of people talk about how Roswell was an example when aliens, and they are, and they still are deeply concerned about our nuclear weapons program, weapons of mass destruction capability. We know that many times flying saucers, alien craft have observed nuclear tests, etc., or have loitered over surveilled Atomic Energy Commission sites, later Department of Energy sites, Hanford, Washington, where the plutonium-239 was manufactured, essentially. Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where they also created plutonium there. In fact, that was like one of the first pilot plants. And also Oak Ridge was known for the uranium enrichment and other places. We know that UFOs have had this proclivity to spy on, surveil, hang around Atomic Energy Commission / Department of Energy sites. But what people don't realize is we often hear about the 509th bomb wing being the only nuclear capable bomb wing in the world in 1947, which is true. But what a lot of people don't understand is the U.S. at that time had a very, very limited supply of atomic bombs. They only had a handful, and of the handful, two or three had to be assembled. These were the Mark III Nagasaki-style plutonium implosion devices, which were very labor-intensive. They had to be put together by hand. The batteries inside them, which would be used to set off the lensed explosives to generate the implosion shockwave to uniformly crush the plutonium pit, that battery had to be replaced fairly rapidly because it would run out of juice, and they'd have to open up the bomb. Had a special device to reach in, pull out the battery, either recharge it or put another battery in. It was very labor intensive. It wasn't until the development of the so-called Mark IV atomic bombs that they were able to go into serial production. Prior to that, with the Mark III Nagasaki bombs, they had to laboriously put together the bombs by hand. It was the series of atomic bomb tests in the Pacific, known as the Sandstone Test, which led to the serial production of what became known as the Mark IV bombs. The Sandstone Tests were meant to determine the efficiency of the so-called levitated cores and the composite cores. Point being is that the Sandstone Test confirmed the efficiency of the levitated cores and the composite cores. They determined that they could use less fissile material but create a greater explosive yield. Moreover, they were now able to design the bombs in such a way that they can go into serial production. We began rolling off the assembly line on March 19th, 1949. At least 500 Mark IVs were manufactured by the time production ceased in 1953. Point of relevance to the Roswell story is we often hear researchers say, well, the 509th bomb ring was the only nuclear capable bomb wing in the world at the time. So, ergo, that was the reason these flying saucers and aliens were hanging about, because there was probably nuclear weapons at Walker Army Air Field, which was not the case. In 1947, the U.S. was still using the Mark III Nagasaki-type bombs. Now, fast forward to the night of December 28, 1980, Bentwaters Air Base in Suffolk County, England. Bentwaters was the repository of the largest tactical nuclear stockpile in Europe at that time. I would recommend the book, The Unsinkable Aircraft Carrier. It goes into detail about how Great Britain was built up as a forward deployment mega base for the Americans. Some of the other key bases used by the Americans was RAF Mildenhall, RAF Lakenheath. I've had friends that served it, or friends who lived on some of these bases because they were dependents. Their fathers were in the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force at the time. The aircraft at Bentwaters and Woodbridge themselves, Woodbridge is the sister base nearby. They did not have nuclear-capable bombers or fighter bombers on the base itself. They had to come from other nearby bases. And again, I really recommend that book, The Unsinkable Aircraft Carrier. It makes for very interesting reading. Although it was written way back when in the 80s or whatever, the information is still valid because it gives you a historical perspective. Anyway, getting back to Rendlesham, fast forward to December 28th, 1980, we're no longer talking about a handful of Mark III Nagasaki type plutonium implosion bombs. We're talking about dozens, if not hundreds, stationed right there at RAF Bentwaters. Understand that the term tactical nuclear weapon is subjective to say the least. The yield can be anywhere from the single digits, some of the so-called backpack nukes, small atomic demolition munitions can be calibrated to go from like half a kiloton up to 5 kilotons, 10 kilotons, whatever the case may be. Some of the other tactical nuclear weapons can have yields in the tens of kilotons and up to hundreds of kilotons, up to 200 kilotons. To give you a comparison, depending on your source, the yield of the Hiroshima uranium 235 device has been variously estimated at 12.7 kilotons to round it up to 15 kilotons. So at the top end, the Hiroshima uranium 235 device was equivalent roughly to 15,000 tons of TNT. But modern day tactical nuclear weapons can have yields many times stronger than that. So it's a very subjective term. They're supposed to be differentiated from strategic nuclear weapons on this basis. Tactical nuclear weapons are meant or intended for use on a battlefield. In the Cold War scheme of things, if hundreds of Russian Soviet tanks were pouring through the Fulda Gap in Europe, it was said that there was nuclear mines and tactical nuclear weapons could be used in order to stop the Soviet armored attack. They were envisioned in some circles as an adjunct to conventional weapons. If things were getting out of hand, if it looks like they were losing the tactical advantage on the battlefield, they can deploy one or two or more tactical nuclear weapons of a relatively low yield. And remember, only quote unquote 12.7 up to 15 kilotons of an atomic blast devastated Hiroshima. So again, we're talking in relative terms here. When we're talking tactical nuclear weapons, the yields would be enough for some of these weapons to destroy a good-sized city. And RAF Bentwaters had the largest repository, excuse me, of tactical nukes in Europe at the time. Was it the nuclear weapons that drew the aliens there? Or were the aliens there to begin with? My feeling is the ETs were always there. They set up a long-standing base there, and the British set up a base there, and eventually the Americans moved in, took a lease out on the base, and conducted their operations there. Certainly, the entities had an interest in the nuclear weapons. I think it was on the same night that Larry and company had their encounter on Capel Green, if memory serves, Steve Longero was in one of the underground bunkers where they store the nuclear weapons, and these beams of light were coming in through the ceiling, and it was sending the personnel into a state of panic, as you can imagine. I've seen this myself when I was in high school. I think I was a sophomore in high school, year 10, in English or Australian terms. I was in the 10th grade, and I was laying in bed at night, and I saw a bright blue beam come in through the ceiling and do what amounted to what seemed to be some kind of a search pattern for whatever reason on my bedroom. Just this beam of light was moving almost like in a searching, scanning fashion at different parts of the floor. And I watched this for a few seconds at least, and I thought immediately aliens, but I quickly blocked that thought out of my mind, pushed it out of my mind. And then I come across this account where these beams of light are going into the storage area. And some of these storage areas for nuclear weapons, they look like big overgrown igloos. And that's where they store a lot of these weapons. And so the personnel in there were watching these beams of light come shining down. And there's an alert on at the base because of all the activity in the forest, what have you. There was a lot of moving parts to the Bentwaters Rendlesham Forest series of incidents. It wasn't just one thing that happened at one place, although what happened with Larry and the personnel there at Cable Green was the high point, if you will. Another issue that needs to be addressed is the collaboration or partnership, if you will, between the aliens beneath the forest there, beneath Rendlesham Forest and beneath the airbase, and the military or deep black elements thereof. Not only was there collusion at some level between the military and the aliens, and these types of alliances, these types of partnerships between humans and non-human beings is not strictly relegated to Bentwaters, far from it. That actually goes on a number of bases, underground bases, and some parts of highly secure surface bases, and has been going on for a long time. And it also turned out that there was a Department of Energy element there. This was told to me by Steve LaPlume, who was told by John Burroughs that Gordon Williams, Colonel Gordon Williams at the time, was deeply upset over the fact that the Department of Energy was conducting operations there, and they were not under his oversight. He had no command and control over them. They were just doing their thing. But what are the odds of the Department of Energy being at a place like Bentwaters when the Department of Energy and in its earliest incarnation, the Atomic Energy Commission, have been deeply, deeply involved with alien technology, back engineering, etc., from the beginning of the modern era? And then it turns out that there's a spooky element there at Bentwaters that the military has no control over. And that came from Gordon Williams, overheard complaining about that by John Burroughs, who turned around and told Steve LaPlume. Steve LaPlume told me and whoever happened to be listening to the show. I thought that was significant. One of the most important aspects of Rendlesham Forest, Bentwaters, is that it raised the bar as far as the research is concerned. Now it's very common amongst podcasters, researchers, investigators, etc., to talk about a deep black liaison between non-human elements and the military. Now, before I go further, I'd like to emphasize that these are my thoughts. That doesn't necessarily jibe with what the main characters involved in RFI, Rendlesham Forest incident or incidences, and Bentwaters believe. They may not believe that there is an ongoing or had been an ongoing relationship, some sort of collusion between the military and the aliens there at Rendlesham. But based on my research and what I've observed and what I know to be true in other bases, other locales, it's quite likely there was some kind of connection back in 1980. I think the connection is deeper than the meeting on the surface between Colonel Gordon Williams and the aliens. Some could describe that event as happenstance. There happened to be alien craft that landed at that particular spot. There happened to be Air Force security personnel in the forest, and they surrounded the landed craft. Larry Warren was not the only person who saw the aliens emerge from the craft. Adrian Bastinza also admitted that he'd seen aliens too. He said this in a taped interview with Linda Moulton Howe. As Larry said, there was some degree of preparedness for the third night's events. Disaster preparedness was present. There were Air Force personnel with movie cameras present. That's not to suggest that the people who sent the cameramen into the forest there knew or expected aliens to show up. But based on what had happened the previous nights, it was a good idea to send cameramen out there just in case something did happen. In the event, aliens did in fact appear and film was taken. And I alluded earlier to the aftermath of the Bentwaters events, the harassment, the drugging of personnel, the efforts to create amnesia in some of the people involved, the missing time that a number of the Air Force personnel had experienced. Larry remembers just waking up in his room there at the base. One moment he's out in the forest, and then the next he's waking up in his room. Now, we know that the military has long utilized mind control and the covert elements of the military, the security elements of the military certainly have used sodium pentothal, truth serum. Some of the operatives very often are dosed with LSD as part of the training program to let them know what it feels like in case they're kidnapped and drugged by the opposition. And back then it would have been Soviet or Soviet affiliated intelligence agencies, intelligence agents. Casey Turner, I mentioned to me that he'd been drugged while he was with the Army Security Agency because he was working, his Cold War job was working in a Army Security Agency listening post. Casey was trained in counter-surveillance techniques, and they dosed him, and they've done this to other people, too. It happened to Thomas Costello, the RAND security specialist who brought out all that information out of Dulce, then had to go on the run. They had likewise dosed him with LSD. The reasoning being is that, well, part of the sordid reasoning is that back in the day, especially under CIA counterintelligence chief James Jesus Angleton, it's pronounced Jesus because his mother was of Mexican descent. James Angleton's father met his mother while stationed in Nogales, Arizona for the U.S. Army. Angleton had force-fed Soviet defector Yuri Nizhenko with LSD for almost an entire year, if memory serves, incredibly high dosages, while keeping Nizhenko in solitary confinement to the point of breaking him and driving him nuts, you can imagine. So the concept of utilizing LSD on people in the intelligence community is the norm, actually. That's not to say that the personnel at Cape Green were dosed with LSD. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that mind control, hypnotic drugs, sodium pentothal, selective externally imposed amnesia, the mind wipes, all those different types of drugs, narcohypnosis, have been utilized for many, many years on people who have witnessed such events in the military or intelligence community. And yet again, we have the same syndrome pop up with Bentwaters. Personnel were debriefed in groups, and they were also, in some cases, messed with individually, interrogated, drugged, experienced missing time. The missing time was twofold. There was missing time in the forest for some of the Air Force personnel, implying that they'd been abducted by aliens. Steve LaPlume did not take part in the third night, December 28, 1980, but he did experience a missing time experience while on guard duty at the base. So on the one hand, personnel were being abducted by aliens and having their memories wiped and recounting what essentially are missing time experiences, but also in the security cover-up, the aftermath, once again, as I alluded to earlier, selective amnesia was imposed harassment, mind control, threats, intimidation, kidnapping of personnel, and being hauled underground. In many ways, Rendlesham Forest / Bentwaters raised the bar of UFO research, and it moved the research in directions a lot of researchers back then, quite frankly, didn't want to go to. So many of them in the past were content with leaving things at a lights in the sky, keep things at an arm's level way of doing things, because that way it's non-threatening. It's nothing you can really sink your teeth into. Bentwaters took that to a whole nother level, which is precisely why there have been so many efforts over the years to debunk the events. It's created this whole slew of oddball characters who had nothing to do with Bentwaters. People like Nick Pope and these people claiming that all the sightings had to do with a lighthouse, and just all this silliness, the hordes of trolls that have been attacking Larry Warren over the years, led by this one woman. I don't even know what her name is. I'm not going to dignify her by even mentioning what her name is. It may not even be a real name. The attacks against Larry were extreme, to the point where they, like I said earlier, they actually assigned a government agent, a spook, Russ Estes, to ingratiate himself into Larry's life and work to subvert and disrupt Larry and his efforts at getting the truth out from within, as it were, by making himself, Russ Estes, a manager, a colleague, a confidant, if you will. Larry's co-writer for his book, Left at Eastgate, he did a 180 and about face. There was a concerted effort to turn a lot of the witnesses against Larry. Larry's testimony took the research, took the event to another level entirely, in a level closer to the bottom line truth, even though some of the other witnesses had described being up close to the craft. Jim Peniston, in one of the earlier nights, was standing alongside of a craft. Later on, he came out with this whole story about binary numbers. I don't even know where to go with all of that. And he was filmed, Jim Peniston was, undergoing a hypnotic regression, during which he pointed out where on his arm, pointing at one of his upper biceps, where he'd been injected with some drug by the spooks. Then Peniston was asked during the regression who he thought these aliens were, and he mentioned he thought that they were humans time traveling from the future or something along those lines, which didn't make sense to me because the beings that were witnessed by Bastinza, Gordon Williams, Larry Warren, and others were quite diminutive, quite small. So if they're from the future, our descendants had shrunk radically. So I don't know what to make of Peniston's story. His account of being alongside the craft in one of the earlier nights, writing notes down, drawing sketches of the craft, that to me has a high degree of veracity and validity, but all this later stuff about binary numbers and what have you, I don't know what to make of that. And also, Peniston has been at the forefront of trying to discredit Larry, which is never a good thing. Having these witnesses hit it against each other, get them bickering against each other, the standard procedure for many years of having all these other witnesses say negative things about Larry, that's a deliberate attack on Larry and Larry's story. And it must be understood as such. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Larry doesn't need me to defend him. He's been doing a great job standing up for himself low these many years. I'm just saying from the outside looking in, it's clear to me there was a concerted effort to discriminate against Larry and thereby make anyone else who wants to come forward disinclined to talk about the same or similar things. That way, the story can just be and remain to be lights in the forest, Air Force personnel chasing after lights, lights in the sky. And that was pretty much standard fare in UFO research circles for decades. Before she died, Georgina Bruni, who wrote the book You Can't Tell the People about Bentwaters, was giving public interviews saying that she had, quote, found a wonderful eyewitness, Jim Peniston. Not so. Larry mentions Jim Peniston in his book, Left at Eastgate. In fact, Larry pointed out at the cafeteria the morning after his experience, there was this buzz going on, people talking about the experience and what have you. And Larry was talking about the experience. And then Peniston at another table yells over, "Hey, Warren, shut the F up." Words to that effect. So Larry was the first one to mention the existence of this guy named Jim Peniston. He was not found and discovered by Georgina Bruni. That must be understood. And from the beginning, you can see from Larry's account that Peniston was trying to keep a lid on this subject as well. I interviewed the aforementioned Georgina Bruni years ago on another podcast that I was a part of. And she did not want to go in the Larry Warren direction. I specifically asked her about Larry, but she refused to talk. Go figure. I'm satisfied that Lieutenant Colonel Halt wrote the so-called Halt memo precisely to minimize the events. Now, when you read the Halt document, some people have rightly described it as being science fiction-like, talking about UFOs and Air Force personnel chasing after lights, but it was a minimalization of events. No way was Halt going to write what really happened out there in that memo, which was written for the Ministry of Defense. There was a concerted effort to minimize the events from the very beginning. And it must always be remembered that it was Larry Warren's efforts working with Fawcett and Greenwood which resulted in the release of the Halt Memorandum in the first place. Again, Bentwaters raises the bar to a whole nother level, which is why it holds such a place of primacy in the UFO literature. And now with the release of this documentary, I think, like I said earlier, it will be the final nail in the coffin to the mainstream media and their never-ending efforts at debunking and marginalizing and dismissing the whole topic of aliens and UFOs. And also, it'll shine a light and hold a mirror up to all the researchers who've marginalized and debunked or tried to debunk Bentwaters RFI. There are a number of new witnesses that have come forward that will appear in this documentary. Witnesses who've never been heard from before. Finally, the world gets to see through the eyes of these witnesses and participants what they experienced, who they are, their backgrounds, their family backgrounds. These are real people that had real experiences. Larry pointed out that on top of everything, it was a human tragedy. It really was. And you talk about an act of betrayal. These were loyal military personnel, Air Force personnel. Generally, you can divide the Air Force personnel into two categories. You have the law enforcement types, and then you had the security specialist who were tasked with guarding the nuclear weapons. Larry Warren falls into the latter category. And you had a mixture of these two units out there in the field, interspersed with disaster preparedness personnel, etc. It will always be open to question why those Air Force personnel were taken by vehicle out to that clearing. There were already some personnel there. It seems like they brought in reinforcements, Larry and others making up the reinforcements, and they went to that particular clearing. Granted, the odd yellow mist was already on the ground. That's a good reason to stop and stare at this thing, wondering if more will happen, and before too long, this red ball of light appears from the North Sea and flies over the yellow mist, stops above it, explodes in a silent explosion. I've told the story earlier, and Larry and others have mentioned this. And then, poof, big soundless explosion of light, and then in its place when people get their vision back is this structured craft. I'm speculating here. Some people in the chain of command knew there was going to be an appearance of a craft at that particular location. And it must be pointed out also, there were civilian witnesses. There were people that lived in homes there adjacent to Capel Green who saw a lot of this activity. There were British bobbies, constables at the scene, who were taking photographs of the landed craft and who had the cameras forcibly confiscated from them. Okay, these are American Air Force personnel off base where they really had no jurisdiction. And then along comes these British constables, I think there were two of them, taking photographs, and then they have their cameras confiscated by the Air Force personnel. So there's a whole aspect of this which reeks of diplomatic international relationship complications and issues. Bentwaters ticks off all these key points of UFO investigations. Some have speculated that the craft that had landed there in the Capel Green clearing was having some kind of technical issues. That would not be surprising, and it would not be a first. We look back to the classic Lonnie Zamora case. He was a New Mexico state trooper. He was hiding behind some rocks, observing this landed egg-shaped craft, two little ETs alight from the craft, look underneath the hull of the craft. It was up on these tripods or landing gear. The little ETs look around the bottom of the craft, the hull. They get back inside, and then they fly away. Point being is that did the craft in Capel Green land there for some repairs? There's been some speculation that they needed help from the Air Force to repair the craft. I have to look more into that and have to talk to more people about that. That's an interesting concept. There's a sense of immediacy to it. It's been 45 years plus, 45 years and about 6 months since these experiences. But there's a sense of immediacy to them. A number of the key witnesses are still alive. We're going to hear from a number of them in this documentary, Capel Green. It's the UFO community at large post these events, December 1980 onwards into the early 80s, mid 80s, 90s, if they had taken Bentwaters seriously, instead of shunning it, instead of trying to marginalize it like Walt Andrus, the director of MUFON, tried to do. Think about that. The director of MUFON tried to poo-poo, tried to marginalize Bentwaters to the point of not even allowing Larry to properly give a presentation about the subject. Larry had to leave the MUFON symposium and give an ad hoc impromptu lecture somewhere else. And a good deal of the audience followed him because they wanted at that time, and people still do, they want to know, get close to the bottom line. What the heck is really going on? I would like to see renewed interest in the subject. A whole nother generation of researchers should really get stuck into Rendlesham, Bentwaters. I would like to see, hopefully, even more witnesses come forward. And granted, there's a lot at risk, a lot that these witnesses can lose. If some of them are still collecting government pensions, that's a disincentive to coming forward. And what they've done to Larry and others, all the harassment meted out to Larry, the incessant attacks of all these trolls, the efforts at besmirching Larry's character by the likes of these Bentwaters hangers-on, as I call them, Nick Pope, who was part of a nothing burger of a MOD agency, the flying complaint, nonsensical, nothing burger of an agency, and yet he's routinely paraded in front of the TV cameras as a UFO expert from the Ministry of Defense of Great Britain, which is utter nonsense. I never took Nick Pope seriously from the moment he first popped up. I never took him seriously. Why should I? The Cable Green documentary will be screened at a limited number of theaters in the UK and elsewhere. And I would encourage my listeners and anyone else out there to try and get your local theaters, especially those theaters that show independent films, to see if they can screen Cable Green, get it out to a larger audience. We've seen the farcical nature of these congressional inquiries into UFOs, or UAPs now, but I refuse to call them UAPs. Rendlesham Forest / Bentwaters deserves to be at the forefront of the research because it ties in with so many other aspects. There's connections between what happened at Bentwaters, Rendlesham Forest, with what was described by Paul Benowitz in Archuleta Mesa in New Mexico, what Thomas Costello described going on at Dulce, what myself and my team had investigated, experienced, discovered in our research efforts in the high desert of Southern California. There are commonalities between all of these. Bentwaters, Rendlesham Forest does not stand alone. There are connections that that series of events has with other similar events, locales, hotspots, if you will, around the world. Let's never forget what happened to Pat Price, the remote viewer who scanned and looked into Mount Hayes in Alaska, the joint alien military base there. And he was eventually bumped off, murdered in Las Vegas. When we watch this documentary, let's remember all the eyewitnesses at Cable Green. And remember, there were upwards of 40 Air Force personnel there. This is not a small number of people who witnessed these events. And there was a larger number in the forest beyond Cable Green who saw parts of these events. And these events stretched over 3 nights. So let's not forget the people who've undergone these experiences, many of them telling their stories for the first time. That's why I'm calling this commentary Rendlesham Rising. Rendlesham is rising once again. Someone the likes of Christopher Mellon and Louis Elizondo and all these other people talk about what they know. Let's go hold our hands up. Wait a minute. What about Cable Green? Right? You're putting the cart before the horse when you talk about Tic Tac videos, and what happened at Cable Green. That's like putting the cart before the horse. Cable Green happened first. Cable Green involved up to 40 or more Air Force security personnel. There was a meeting between Colonel Gordon Williams and aliens. Larry Warren was within touching distance of the landed craft. So was Adrian Bastinza. Again, there's a sense of immediacy to these events, even after 45 years. So when you get the opportunity, plug into this documentary. Hopefully, you'll be able to get it screened at your local theaters. And I encourage everyone, when this video becomes available, get yourself a copy and get the word out. Because this is going to be a earth-shaking event in our field of UFO research. So thank you so much for listening once again. You've been listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars, special edition called Rendlesham Rising. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.